This is a London Undone podcast. My name is Catherine Cartwright. These podcasts give you an audible insight into some curious places around London. This series focuses on the historic and at times peculiar City of London churches, their histories, features, associations, and their spiritual lives.
I'm Signe Hoffus. I'm a friend of the City Churches and a former trustee of the Friends of the City Churches, a volunteer church watcher.
And we're sitting today in St. Margaret Lothbury. Can you tell me first about the name?
Good question. Lots of people write about it, nobody really knows. John Stowe, the wonderful Elizabethan chronicler, suggests it's because so many loathsome trades were practiced up here. It was, even in Roman period, known for brass foundries, which is a really noxious trade, terrible smell and dirt. So there were a lot of foundries around here, and indeed Founders Hall, and that is in fact one of the livery companies associated with this church, the Founders, is right next door here. So loathe makes a nice segue, even though it probably doesn't hold up for students of the language. And Bury in a city tends to mean stronghold. Yeah. In an urban context like this, sometimes it's reduced to something like court.
It's interesting. And St. Margaret, who was she?
One of the amazing number of virgin martyrs who suffered under Diocletian around about 304. Seas of blood spent in that very period, legendarily. In her case, she was actually swallowed by a dragon and regurgitated. So the church does tend to bracket her with a few of the less verifiable saints. But she was enormously popular and is a patron, for example, of pregnant women, of female servants, of exiles, of peasants, of the downtrodden. And she has wonderful iconography because she's one of the few women you'll see standing on a dragon.
Yes, yes.
Well, there were four St. Margaret's at one point in the City of London.
And now just the two. Can you go into a bit more detail on where this church is located?
We are now at the absolute epicentre of the City of London as a financial centre because we're directly across the street from the fortress, which is the Bank of England, with its huge curtain walls concealing its mysteries. That wasn't always the case, and that is closely interlinked to the history of the churches, the rise of commerce and the decline of religion in the city. But this is the northwest corner of the city, so we're just around the edge of the city wall, approaching the Barbican. And so this was where a lot of the outliers would have been historically. And you look at certainly Elizabethan maps, and they're, you know, cows and fields,
yes.
So not far from here.
Yeah.
It was really not much populated until the real modern period begins.
And do we know when there first stood a church on this site?
The usual result is that it's probably first mentioned around 1181, which is a seminal document which lists all kinds of churches, though other people say 1197. And the first priest was apparently Reginald, and he dates to just a little after that. And then the record goes quite quiet until the very beginning of the 1300s. And then the list of incumbents is quite solid.
Okay.
So it's a little uncertain what was happening here at the very beginning. But there was definitely something to be rebuilt around about 1440, 41, probably with the money of a recently deceased Lord Mayor.
Okay.
Who's Robert Large, whose main claim to fame historically now is an employer, because it was to him that Caxton was apprenticed.
Ah.
He was a very successful man in his own right. He was an MP, he was a Lord Mayor, you know, a very successful merchant, a member of the Mercer's Company. And it was quite a common thing in that period for individuals to bequeath such large sums of money that churches could be built or rebuilt.
Right.
Although the parish undoubtedly had a hand in it.
Yes. Robert Large.
Yes. And it was his period, in fact, the church was enlarged, even though it was what we would now call a brownfield site.
Yeah.
They found some more space because it actually went further east, looking at the archaeological evidence, and was built on arches over the River Walbrook, which basically flows under the chancel.
Yes.
Of course, now in a honking great sewer.
Yeah.
But if you actually walk the course in the church. You'll see there's a little dip up toward the chancel, the holiest part of the church where the altar is,
yes.
and the floor, which is part of the arches over the Walbrook River.
I nearly tripped as I was walking down that earlier.
Yes.
That must have been it.
Yes.
I did think, well, this is uneven. I thought it was just the carpet, but clearly it was that.
And it has posed some challenges to the history, physical history of the building, but like so many of these, it was very well built fundamentally, and it's still holding up despite great provocation from all the other things that have happened around it since the Middle Ages.
So it was rebuilt in 1441 and was destroyed in the Great Fire of London.
Well, even more annoying for the parishioners, they spent a fair amount of money on refurbishing it in 1621. And then 40 years later, at least most of the people who put the money up in 1621 had probably died by 1666.
Yes.
But wouldn't that frost you?
How annoying.
Yes. Yes.
Depending on whether they like the refurb or
not. Yes.
Christopher Wren comes along after the Great Fire of London. Can you tell me what happened, how it was rebuilt?
Well, it'd be interesting to know because it's one of the last to get started and to get finished. So it starts maybe around 1683. Sources vary a little, and it's finished by, say, 1692 at the latest. Some people say a little earlier, but when is a church ever finished? And in fact, after that, they just carry on, and so the tower is finished about 1700. And some other churches had to wait another generation before they finished the tower.
Yes.
So this one seems to have been pretty much contiguous in the building.
Yes. And do we know to what extent Christopher Wren actually played a part in its design? Because I know in some of the other churches, other people were involved.
Well, he doesn't seem to have been as intimately involved as this, as say, St. Stephen Walbrook. But then again, this isn't a masterpiece.
Yes.
It's a good, handsome, serviceable church.
Yes.
And much of what you see now is far post-Wren in the ordering of the church. So it was one of the more pedestrian but serviceable ones on a fringe location. And we know his pal Hook had a hand in it. And we do think that the top of the tower, there's a lovely little lead spire there, was probably by Hook.
Yes.
And that's a hoot to read about because the Victorian commentators think it's just appalling. And Pevsner, the great 20th century historian, who's very hard to please, thinks it's delightful. So it hasn't changed one iota in all these centuries, but the attitude toward it keeps changing.
I wonder what people think of it today. Probably just don't care anymore.
Yeah. It's cute. It's small. It's rather sweet. Yeah.
So from the outside, can you describe it? Please.
It's one of those that you walk past and you won't almost not notice, partly because this tiny little stretch of road, Lothbury, is just basically a block long, and it is facing the Bank of England, which rather dominates the scene. But it is a charming little bit of older London. It's not very, very old, but it's one of the few remaining pockets where all the buildings are of an age and all architecturally interesting without being intrusive and all medium rise.
Yes.
All of which are mercies in the modern city.
Yes.
So the church presents a very plain front. You'll see by the windows, when you look twice, and the doors, three big arched windows, and the towers, a giveaway that you're looking at a church.
Yeah.
But if you walk right past it, you might not even realize that there is indeed a church there, except that it is a very welcoming building, and the door is almost always open during office hours.
Yes.
They really do encourage people to come in, and they do have very popular services.
Yes. And then you come in, and can you describe the interior a bit? I know that's quite a big ask because there's so much to see here. So take your time.
Well, that is, as we've said in earlier podcasts, it's a feature of the city churches that they often look like nothing on the outside. Again, because after 1666, public money went into building the exteriors, and there was a big shortage of materials and a big shortage of labor because everybody's rebuilding everything at the same time. So they just whomp up the exterior. And then the parish pays for the interior. And here what you're seeing is not what the parish would have left round about 1700. It involves a great deal of later additions. And it's even rather unprepossessing as you walk in nowadays, although I'm sure it helps with the central heating, because you walk into a large corridor,
yes.
and then you turn to your right, and suddenly, wow, you're in basically a museum of church woodwork. Yes. There's just woodwork everywhere.
Yes, it's spectacular. So tell me a bit about the woodwork, if you'd like to start there.
And this is a two-part equation, because a little bit of it seems to be original to this church during the Wren's rebuilding, like the rather small but quite sweet pulpit, for example, and the communion table, and bits and pieces all over them. But a large part of what you're seeing has come from other city churches as they were systematically demolished in the late 19th century. Because, of course, that's a period when, with the public transport being so much improved and suburban houses being so much better places to live than the decrepit stock in the city, the population just moved en masse to the edges and depleted the demand for city churches. And so eventually the diocese had to make a decision and elected to demolish a number and move many of the furniture and fittings systematically to other churches. Mm. The interesting thing is that some of the city churches seem to have got first pick of this rather good stuff, and it didn't go to the godless suburbs, it stayed in the city. And here particularly it's an incumbent named Ingram, who seems to have been quite adroit in walking around other people's demolition sites and just picking up little bits and pieces. But on the other hand, to his credit, the things that are here are the things that the modern churches wouldn't have wanted. So this beautiful, huge tester, the big hood over the rather tiny pulpit underneath, is from All Hallows the Great. And that was, again, not a thing that a modern church would want. In fact, many churches that had them were getting rid of them by this point. They do help acoustically, but they're seen as remnants of another age.
Yes.
There was a tester originally belonging to this church, which is obviously not as ornate as the one they took in return for All Hallows. And that went to St. Paul's Hammersmith, and now it's gone to Fulton, Missouri. And it's in the reconstructed Church of St. Mary Aldermanbury,
really?
Which was built there in the 1960s, in fact. But it was sent as a gift after 9/11.
Right.
As another gesture of friendship between the churches. And this amazing screen across the front of the main body of the church, stretching from one side to the other, is from All Hallows the Great, which was on Thames Street, near the epicenter of the Hanseatic League, the Steel Yard, down by the Steel Yard. And that was a Germanic group, the Hanseatic League, Baltic traders.
Yes.
And it's possibly not coincidental that it features this honking great eagle in the middle of the carved screen. It was traditionally thought to have been the gift of one particular merchant there. Now it's believed to be actually the work of the parish, having commissioned it properly. And it also has, just to make sure that we understand who's in charge here, we have the eagle, which is not really a very British symbol. And then above that, we have a royal coat of arms, just to demonstrate that it's the monarchy of Britain, who's in charge. And it is a beautiful screen. There's only one other screen in the City of London. That's St. Peter Cornhill. Yeah. So you don't find screens very commonly at all in Anglican churches. Really a remnant of medieval practice.
Yes. And it has these very unusual pillars.
Lovely little twisted barley sugar, sort of open barley sugar pillars, barely holding up the weight above them, but also giving you a good clear view of what's actually happening at the altar and in the chancel. And that is the important thing from the Anglican perspective, that the screen is not like the screen in the Greek Orthodox tradition, for example, where the holiest bit is actually behind the screen and the most holy icons. And here it's the exact opposite. You want to be able to see what's going on as much as possible. So the screen is lovely and light and just almost like tracery. And then this huge, rather heavy canopy out across the top of it, which again, even Pevsner thought was a little bit de trop, given the delicacy of the screen and then the size of the carving in the center. What was probably quite a dullish box to begin with, as Wren last saw it, is actually now a very interesting place with lots of demarcation.
I have to say, the screen is the standout feature of the church.
Yeah.
I mean, you come in and the first thing you see is that, and it's quite unusual
for
the reasons you've explained.
You really can't miss it, no.
Is there anything to say about the two paintings that are either side of the altar?
This is another phenomenon of the City of London churches. And the original reredos, as you can see, is rather sweet, and it has the Ten Commandments in the middle and the Creed on one side. and the Lord's Prayer on the other. And often you will have on the flanks of these two little representations of Moses and Aaron. But they don't do it by halves here. These are actually larger than the reredos by some distance. And they're from the Lost Church of Christopher Lestocq, which was pretty much the first one to be finished around about 1681, and definitely the first one to be demolished around about 1781 for the building of the Bank of England. The long contest by this point is between God and Mammon, and by the late 18th century, Mammon is tending to win out. Right. So around here, for example, a couple of churches were demolished to build the Stock Exchange.
Right.
When it needed space. And of course, the Stock Exchange can basically operate out of a small office with a lot of screens these days. But when it was mammoth, it needed space, and two churches were knocked down to accommodate that. And poor old Christopher Lestocq's only a century old, and even its dead had to be transferred to make space for the Bank of England.
So, thinking of the dead, there are plenty of memorials on the wall around here. Are any of them of note or interesting or worth talking about?
They're almost all lovely. I mean, and because this church, interestingly, survived the war, I mean, the war, the Second World War, with really nothing much to worry about. You notice the windows are conspicuously modern, but that's a feature of a lot of churches. And if they were happy to lose some of their Victorian glass, they sometimes just let the hand of God make that decision. And God usually said, kapow. And now we have some lovely modern windows with lovely hand-blown panes that help to obscure the ghastly buildings on the other side. Yeah. And some lovely colored glass representing some of the several livery companies associated with this church. Most of the monuments of themselves are rather plain but handsome. The most striking are the busts. And there's in fact, three of them. One we think is by a man named Le Sueur, and one by Nollekens, and rarely one of a woman, Mrs. Simpson.
Oh, wow.
Not that Mrs. Simpson.
Right. Yes. Okay, so when you come in through into the main area of the church, you look up to the left and there is a bust there. Is that the one that might be by Le Sueur?
Yeah, we think so. And I believe it had a little bit of a checkered history and it kind of went away and it came back again. But here it is, and it's in a good, safe position up the wall. Yes.
And do we know who it depicts?
The lovely bust is Sir Peter Le Maire, of a man of Huguenot descent, and there's a lot of them, particularly associated with big money in the city, allegedly by Le Sueur and from the Church of St. Christopher Lestocq, and probably circa 1631, which makes it a lot earlier than most everything else in these post-fire churches. Yeah. But there were a fair number of survivals from various churches, either because they were providentially taken away before the fire, or they survived the fire because the fire wasn't equally devastating across the entire city.
Yes.
And because they get reverentially moved from one church to another when things get knocked down.
And Le Sueur was the sculptor who did the Charles I statue in the centre of London.
This church has an interesting royalist history as well, in that things were very contentious during the civil wars and the Commonwealth thereafter, and indeed sometime after that. And at one point, the actual incumbent here was at complete loggerheads with the congregation, because he was a red-hot royalist, and they were red-hot parliamentarians. And they eventually basically rose up against him, and there's this shocking entry about how his wife and children were basically thrown into the street at midnight during this contention. So you look at some of the lists of previous incumbents, and they look very innocent, but some of them have very high drama behind the names, especially when the dates happen to fall around these periods when there were momentous things happening in the city churches.
And then to Mrs. Simpson. So where is she?
She's over to the...
Oh, yes.
You can just see her in the little chapel, which we haven't reached yet.
Yes.
But a fairly rare survival to have something of that size and quality, and to a woman.
So do we know anything about her?
I don't know much at all, and I have been looking for her, but basically she just had money.
Okay.
Yeah.
Let's move on to the chapel. So, yes, on the south side of the church, there's a separate area which is also separated by a screen.
So it's a whole second... second little church, basically. Mm. It's got its own little communion table. It's got its own little reredos. And that was interestingly painted by a female religious named Sister Catherine Weeks, around about 1908 when all this was happening. Pevsner thinks it's incongruous and doesn't like it at all, but it is rather affecting as a period. But it does make a lovely extra space for private worship, although it changes substantially what you would have seen in the Wren period church. It all works very successfully here, and it really does make for an awfully interesting building with two separate worship spaces.
And anything to say about the chandeliers? Just because they've been swinging non-stop, at least that one has.
Yes.
It's sort of almost like some kind of hypnotic tool.
They're also a bit of a canary in the mineshaft to tell you how much vibration these buildings put up with. Because what we also have in the distant background now is building noise. And there's so much construction around here. And every time you do that, it's hard on the older buildings.
Yes.
So it's, as I say, a tribute to everyone who, especially involved in the medieval foundations of this church, and over, under such challenging circumstances, given that it's built over a river, that it's actually still standing and in pretty good shape.
Is there anything else that you feel needs sharing about the organ, the gallery? I don't know.
The organ's yet another import, and it's by George England. So about 1801.
Yeah.
So a relatively late addition to the city organ anthology. There's also a lovely little monument within the chancel to a family who were buried here for quite some time. The first churches to close to burials are the City of London ones in 1850. And this particular family went to Kensal Green, so it's like a forwarding address on the monument. It tells you, and for the rest of us, come to Kensal Green.
This That's where we've gone.
Yes.
How funny.
One other interesting feature in the long contest to save churches, and we're going through probably another one of them quite shortly, with the Church of England really seriously having to reconsider how to handle all this material wealth and assets when with declining church populations. As late as 1947, the Bank of England offered to buy this while the church was considering what to do with all the war-damaged churches, because they wanted to knock it down and build some ancillary office space.
Really?
And then this was actually one of the churches which really was not affected by the war. So as you imagine, they actually got from the commissioners a rather dry reply, which didn't actually mention the words hell and freezing over, but did suggest that they were unlikely to be successful in this application at this time. So it's a constant struggle just to keep an eye on mammon to protect these last few little treasures of God. And can you imagine what the street would look like? This lovely little street. It's so short. It's so charming. And then whomp, there would have been some 1950s concrete or brick. And, oh, it's hard to be. Yes, I mean, I'm sure they need space, but they're always going to need space.
Yes.
And the font is one of the glories and also one of the mysteries. It has four biblical scenes on each of its faces, the font base. And they're very similar to one which is which is documented by Grinling Gibbons.
Yes.
And it's much in his style, but no one can quite prove it, which is just endlessly frustrating. And then the font cover itself comes from Lawrence Jewry. Again, so much of this displaced furniture. There should be really an interactive version of this, so you could just like tap the screen and see where things have come from.
They need the QR code stuck on every bit of every item you can see. Yes. Thank you. I'm glad you mentioned that. I'll take a photograph to add to it as well. Quite hard taking photographs in here because everything seems quite high up. Everything begins at head height.
Yes. Well, if you could imagine when it had box pews, and it surely had box pews, it would have been more, even darker and more constrained.
Yes.
But it would have been much of a muchness to have had taller enclosed pews.
That's right.
But this gives you such wonderful sight lines. And even though, as Pevsner says, it's a little disproportionate the size of the tester and the top of the screen to some of the delicacy of beneath, somehow it doesn't jar. It doesn't interrupt your view of the church. It just all harmonizes. And the detested very dark woodwork, which some people deplore because it would originally have been much lighter, actually works beautifully here against the light walls and all the windows.
Yes.
Lots and lots of windows. And that gives you a completely different impression of the church than you get in some which are hemmed in and windowless, virtually.
Yes, it's a funny mixture of feeling quite dark and yet very light.
Yes.
Because there are so many windows.
You're aware of the dark woodwork and you don't realize until you look twice that, in fact, there are windows on three sides letting light in, whereas in many churches there are windows are constrained by the buildings next to them. And it has a nice modern glass now, which both masks the buildings behind but also lets in a lot of light.
Yes.
And when you try and visualize it as it would have been, I mean, when Wren walked out the door, take away almost everything that dominates the visual landscape now, and you would have been down to a modest little pulpit and the rather grand reredos, but grander in context when there wasn't the screen and there wasn't that screen and there wasn't that tester, and it would have been so much, and certainly it wasn't Moses and Aaron.
Yeah.
It would have been so much simpler when Wren last saw it.
Yes.
And for about the next 100 years. And then it starts to heat up after the demolition of St. Christopher the Stocks in the late 18th century.
When everything was brought in.
And then more and more things are brought in. And the dynamic of the church changes. But it isn't compromised. It just becomes a different church.
Yeah.
Wren would probably fall over to see what's happened subsequently. But I don't think he'd object.
Yes.
It's all been done so sensitively. And it brings the history of this church in line with the whole of the city, because there are elements of virtually everything that happens in the history of the city you can find traces of right down to the River Walbrook and the Roman brass foundries. I mean, there are little bits and pieces of so much city history in this very building.
Yeah.
It's remarkable.
Yeah.